All right, here we go. So, we're going to discuss partial differential equations and how to solve them. And we'll come back to the FOIL set, which actually gives the physical background for this, which is one really on computational fluid dynamics and other physical simulation methods, problems. Probably should switch. There's a light switch over there. All right. So, partial differential equations are probably the dominant form of any fundamental simulation. The other two major forms are Monte Carlo methods and particle dynamics. But I think if you look at, say, the NSF supercomputer centers, I would imagine 50% or maybe more of their applications are some form of partial differential equation, and the others with smaller numbers of Monte Carlo, and then probably yet smaller numbers of particle dynamics. So here are a few examples. Airflow over a wing, radar waves bouncing off aircraft or what have you, blood circulation in the human body. Yesterday I was in an all-day meeting about simulating numerical black holes, the collision of black holes, and there we have climate models. So in each case, you have a physical system for which there are relatively fundamental equations written down describing fields or densities, and then you wish to solve that numerically. A differential equation set is called partial if and only if there are at least two variables, two independent variables. So ordinary differential equations have one variable, typically time, which is differentiated. Partial differential equations have two or more. The simplest type of differential equations, which you will find endless computer science papers discussing, is the Laplacian operator, which is called del squared, and del squared is d squared psi dx squared plus d squared psi dy squared plus d squared psi dz squared. These examples up here have a far richer set of differential equations. Right. So there are three typical examples of partial differential equations and three corresponding classifications. In practice, there are really only two. The most important is the one here, mainly because it's the hardest. These are hyperbolic equations. And this is what you almost always get if you have any sort of time dependence in the problem. So the simplest hyperbolic differential equation is the wave equation, which is del squared of psi equals 1 over c squared d psi squared dt squared, and this particular equation would describe the evolution of waves in whatever number of dimensions del squared is. This would be a partial differential equation even if del squared was in one dimension. because we have the time derivative there, because then we'll have one space and one time dimension, and that total is two differentials, so that's partial. And so this describes the transmission of waves and so this could, I mean, the applications of the, where you actually do get waves, if you, as I may have mentioned, Syracuse University is famous for its work in computational electromagnetics, where Tappan Sarkar is probably the best known numerical person here. Professor Roger Harrington just retired. He was the founder of one of the major methods of solving those equations. And so those solve so-called Maxwell's equations, which are the equations describing electromagnetic waves. And this is a very important set of problems, all the way from military calculations to decide whether a particular aircraft has a good or bad radar signature, or if you're Motorola building the next generation of cellular phones, you want to know if your circuit, what the radiation of your circuit is, and whether there's crosstalk between the different components of the circuit. So this type of computation is of great importance both for the military and to the manufacturer of very high-speed circuits. It doesn't, Maxwell's equations are not too important for more traditional digital circuits, at least not at the moment, because the radiation is not big enough. As I mentioned, numerical relativity, the collision of black holes is interesting because Einstein predicted that there would be waves in coming from general relativity, and so these are just oscillations in the fabric of space-time. So here the thing that so for the first case of psi is an electric or magnetic field. For numerical relativity, of psi is a metric tensor, a component of a metric tensor describing your local coordinate worlds, and gravitational waves are meant to be emitted by various sources, such as black holes, when they collide, and those gravitational waves can be detected, at least it's believed they can be detected on Earth by some incredibly ingenious system where essentially you're trying to measure when a gravitational wave hits something which is massive, it will move that massive thing by a tiny amount. And so they have an ingenious system for detecting the tiny variations that come when a gravitational wave hits something on Earth. So anyway, so that's a pretty interesting set of equations. The next classification of an equation, which is actually technically is so similar to hyperbolic equations, and most that is really not really practically a terribly separate case, but if you read any of the books, it's viewed as a separate case. It's called a parabolic equation. And in the wave equation, we had del squared of psi equals 1 over c squared d of psi d squared of psi d c squared. For the parabolic equation, you get, instead of d psi squared dt squared, you get d psi dt. You just get a single derivative. So that's a so-called diffusion equation, and that describes any diffusive process such as heat transfer. So because of the single derivative, that has a very different effect, as you know, because when you have a source of waves, those waves go to infinity with constant amplitude. When you have a parabolic equation, you have a source of heat and then it diffuses away, the amplitude of that heat gets smaller and smaller as you get further and further away from the source. It decays exponentially. So there's a tremendous difference between parabolic and hyperbolic equations. So elliptic equations are extremely important. They are somewhat easier. They're not quite, they're probably the easiest to solve, which actually makes them important because those are the easiest. You can actually do a good job or a relatively good job, and most problems have elliptic equations connected to them. So in the numerical relativity case, we actually have a hyperbolic equation describing the evolution of the gravitational waves, but at fixed time one needs to solve an elliptic equation to find the solution at fixed time of the gravitational field. But the more conventional example of an elliptic equation is just electrostatics. If you have a bunch of charges, those charges have an electric field, or actually if you have a bunch of gravitating particles, those have a gravitational field in classical physics. Those are the field created by the electrostatic field, or the gravitational field in those circumstances, is described by Laplace's equation, or more generally by Poisson's equation, where you have minus 4 pi rho, where rho is the density of either gravitational or electric density. So physically you can think of elliptic equations as non-time evolution equations. Wave equations is time evolution with two derivatives, parabolic time evolution with one derivative. Elliptic equations are no time evolution. That's not the technical definition, but that's the sort of practical definition. Alright. So, as we already discovered for ordinary differential equations, boundary conditions are both necessary and critical for solving such ordinary differential equations, and that's even more true with partial differential equations. Indeed, the problem is ill-posed unless you give a boundary condition. I mean, it's mathematically ill-defined. And there are various forms of boundary conditions, and these particular, technically these differential equations are actually defined in some sense by a structure which is strongly connected with the type of boundary conditions that are appropriate. The natural type of boundary conditions, if you think about say the heat equation, diffusion equation, physically what you would normally do is you would say, I have a source of heat at a particular position, how much heat is there at later times further away from that source of heat, because it diffuses through the media and it changes, it starts off at zero outside the source, and then you'll get more heat as the results of the source diffuses in time. So that is like, that is rather like the types of boundary conditions we had with particle dynamics. When we did particle dynamics, the classic boundary conditions we had were initial value boundary conditions, that you knew where the particle was, and you actually knew its velocity at a particular time, find out where it was at a later time. So that's a classic initial value condition. So those are called, the analog of those is called a Cauchy condition. And so instead of having the value and its time derivative given at a particular point, which is the classic thing we think of for ordinary differential equations, these second order ordinary differential equations, we have to imagine the value being given on a curve instead of at a point in two dimensions, and rather than the, we need the value and we need the derivative in the direction perpendicular to that curve. So supposing we had the so here we are specializing for second order differential equations, and so the suppose I had the value and its normal derivative, we could naively say that we could obviously calculate the solution near here by just doing a Taylor expansion about the point. So to do a Taylor expansion, which just means you take the x and the y values and expand out in terms of expansion in terms of the differentials, you could do that as long as this differential equation tells you what the higher derivatives are. That will work as long as this this equation here can be solved, and the condition for it to be solved is the condition that you have a hyperbolic equation. Parabolic and elliptic equations, parabolic lie in between elliptic and hyperbolic, and elliptic are characterized by not being able to solve the differential equations and not being able to use a Taylor series. Alright. So, what I had there was a curve. There is another class of boundary conditions, which is to give the conditions on a closed surface or a closed curve. It's a surface in three or more dimensions. It's a curve in two dimensions. Then, if you have a closed curve and you want to specify the values on the closed curve, then it would not be reasonable to specify the value and its derivative on a closed curve, because if I have the value and the derivative here, I ought to be able to move it forward in time and find the value here. So it only makes it does not make sense to specify value and derivative on a closed curve. The only thing it makes sense to specify value and derivative on is an open curve, one that goes to infinity. So that would be like in the diffusion problem, defining the conditions on the line time equals naught. That's an open curve. The conditions on a boundary would be, if I have an electrostatic problem, saying that I have a certain voltage on a condenser, could be a closed curve. So when you have a closed curve, the only boundary conditions you're allowed to specify, you can't specify value and derivative, you have to specify value or derivative. So Cauchy conditions are value and derivative on an open curve. So that's what it says here. That's typified by the wave equation. The elliptic equation is value or derivative on a closed curve. If you specify the value, those happen to be called the Richelet boundary conditions. If you happen to specify the normal derivative, that is called the Neumann boundary condition. And so that's that. And then the parabolic equation turns out to be a case where, because we only have a single time derivative, we need one less boundary condition anyway. Remember, if you think about ordinary differential equations, I need value and derivative because it's a second for Newton's equations because they're second order. If I had a first order equation, I would only need value because then the first order equation tells me anything. So as diffusion is first order, you only need Dirichlet or Neumann conditions on an open curve. The way to think about elliptic equations is to think about it, it's very similar to a so-called boundary value problem when you have an ordinary differential equation. Namely, when you have an ordinary differential equation, there are actually two formulations. You want to find a solution between x equals a and x equals b. You can specify for a second order ordinary differential equation the value and the derivative at x equals a, then you just integrate in time, or you can specify the value at a and the value at b, find the solution in the middle. And physical, I mean, if you do particle dynamics for ordinary differential equations, you always have value and derivative at a particular point, because one of these, you're integrating the ordinary differential equation in time. When I have I'm trying to solve for some shape of a drum or something with certain boundary conditions on the edge, or shape, then that's a boundary value problem where I have the values at each end but not the derivatives. So those are actually harder to solve for ordinary differential equations because there's no deterministic way of getting it. Because if you know the value at the beginning and the value at the end, that is two conditions, but the differential equation being second order only tells you, doesn't directly tell you how to solve those equations. So actually elliptic look e harder because elliptic there is no deterministic way of finding the solution, whereas actually for hyperbolic they're totally deterministic. You take the values at a particular time and integrate them forward in time. So in some sense hyperbolic seem the easiest. The reason why they're hardest is they always diverge, at least nearly always diverge. Like this black hole project we have, which is now in its third year, we do not have a stable solution. We cannot integrate these equations without them blowing up. Even though Einstein wrote these equations and they're just one line. He wrote them whenever it was, in 70 years ago, 80 years ago. And they're in some sense are trivial equations, but when you apply the very careful numerical methods and integrate them in time, the equations become unstable and the errors accumulate and you get infinite answers, I mean numerically infinite answers. So this very talented group of some 30 physicists are struggling over these and related issues. So they're very, 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 typically hyperbolic equations are very hard. So this is a typical diffusion equation. We have a rod here, we have time here, we have some initial distribution of heat on the rod. We probably have some fixed endpoints which have fixed temperature. Then we need to calculate the temperature as a function of time throughout the rod. So that's a classic diffusion equation. You are given conditions on an open surface like this. So this is x, the length along the rod, this is time. Let me think. Here is an example of fluid flow for Laplace's equation. Fluid flow is, when done in its full complexity, is determined by hyperbolic equations, the so-called Navier-Stokes equations, which are extremely hard to solve. However, under some conditions, you can solve them with elliptic equation. And then if you wish to discuss here the you want to solve for the motion of a fluid in a pipe. Now this is x, not t, because whenever you see t, you should expect to see a parabolic or hyperbolic equation, because that's what time always corresponds to. Sometimes x and y will correspond to hyperbolic, but time will almost all, because I mean, that's just sort of Mother Nature. I mean, Mother Nature evolves things in time. So anything which has time almost has to have a hyperbolic or parabolic form, because we know physically that it's sort of unreasonable to say, all right, time naught is this, you know, time this plus 80, you know, we could, if we were allowed to set boundary conditions in time, we would all be in great shape. You could say, well, t equals naught, we'll get born, t equals 80 years, we'll retire with $100 million worth of bank balance, and we'll just solve the differential equations with those boundary conditions, and you know, it'll be fine. So we know that this is not possible to predict ahead in time, because the equations do not allow that. Nature does not allow us to specify the boundary conditions at the beginning and the end in time. But in space it does. We are allowed to specify what happens at the beginning of a pipe and at the end of a pipe, and find out what happens in the middle. Because space is instant. I mean, at a given time, we are allowed to specify a closed curve in space and specify the boundary conditions. That makes physical sense. What unphysical is specifying it at the beginning and the end in time. So this will be an example of an elliptic equation in the so-called Euler's equations, which are the type of what happens to the Navier-Stokes equations when you approximate them, and then you get elliptic equations out of them. Okay. And of course we know, we can specify, because we imagine this pipe is in some infinite fluid, we can know what happens here and here. These are the sides of the pipe which will have some condition which will be typically such that the velocity is zero, because fluid sticks to the side of a pipe and has to have zero velocity there. Alright. So we're now creeping up to this Jacobi iteration that we already have actually introduced. So that Jacobi iteration, which we even did a bit of last time, corresponds to an elliptic equation, and so the classic way of solving elliptic equations is by finite differences, which is essentially the obvious extension from one dimension to two dimensions of the way we solved ordinary differential equations. To solve an ordinary differential equation, I divided the independent variable into typically equidistant grid points, and then we just wrote down the appropriate approximation to the differential, and then we converted the differential equation into a difference equation. We now have to do the it's obvious that we can do the same thing in two dimensions by just dividing both x and y into equally spaced intervals, and it is not necessary for x and y to have the same spacing, although in the in the way I've drawn it, they look as though they have the same spacing. So now we have to, in order to be able to solve this numerically, we need to convert the differential equation into a difference equation, which basically means that we want to, instead of having a differential at this point with del squared, d squared upsi dx squared plus d squared upsi dy squared, if we do Laplace's equation, we need an equation which involves the values of the function at neighboring points, because we know that the differential here can be related to the to a function of the values at the point and its neighboring points. So that's a trivial extension from one dimension to two dimensions of what we did before. And so it is very easy by just doing Taylor series to find out that d squared of psi dx squared, if we have a good side of h, that h squared d squared of psi dx squared is just a psi of x plus h comma y plus a psi of x minus h comma y minus 2 of psi xy. So that's just applying that's just doing Taylor expansion. And so so that's what I wrote here. D squared of psi dx squared is the rightmost value minus twice the center value plus the leftmost value. If I now add that for x and y, we're going to get something which will have the left minus twice the center plus the right, the up minus twice the center plus the down. So this is in the stencil, this is just one down in the y direction. And the reason we get, so when we add these together, we're going to get the this magic combination that we saw discussion of the Jacobi iteration, which is the left plus the right plus the top plus the bottom minus 4 times the middle value. So that when we divide by 4, that's the average of the neighbors minus the middle. So that says that del squared is 4 times 4 over h squared times the average of the 4 neighbors minus the middle. So that's sort of why this is a very important quantity. Obviously, if I did this in three dimensions, I would get the three-dimensional average, which is called 6 terms, minus, and is divided by 6, minus the middle. Because if I have three of them, I just add a z plus h and a z minus h minus 2 of psi xy again. And so when I add them all together, I only get a 6 times of psi xy. And then I'll have 6 terms. This is the simplest possible approximation. When we did ordinary differential equations, we noted that there were some extremely complicated formulae for the differential operator. When we did the Adams-Bashford formulae and things like that, and instead of the simplest Taylor expansion, we used Taylor expansions with keeping higher order terms, and we got much more complicated expressions for the differential operator. And so you're allowed to do the same here and get far more complicated expressions. However, they'll all have roughly the same form. For the second order derivative, it's got to go like 1 over h squared the stuff in the middle is some linear combination of the values of psi near the point xy. It may not just be the nearest neighbors, which are the ones we have here. They could be two or three away if you use a very high order approximation, but there's some mix of the values. And you may remember I did this analysis of how I changed the I looked at the ratio of computation to communication depending on how many points away the fundamental algorithm sort of touched. And that would come in here by what approximation I used here. If I used a higher order approximation, I'd get an algorithm which touched more points. You may remember I noted that actually if you touch more points, you've got a more efficient parallel algorithm, because you tend to do more computing per communication. So if I'm just solving Laplace's equation, which is del squared of psi equals naught, we just get the equation that we've already seen, that psi of x of y is equal to the average of its neighbors. So if I now replace these x, y values of the grid points by indices I and j, you just get a bunch of linear equations, because there are nx times ny of these values, and so you'll get one linear equation for every internal point. I've defined it so the internal points are nx times ny, and so the point 0 and nx plus 1 and 0 and ny plus 1 are the boundaries. And so you'll get nx times ny equations for nx times ny unknowns, because the unknowns are the interior points. So these are a set of coupled linear equations. So so the mathematical formulation of Laplace's equation is a set of linear equations. So that's why when you look at the mathematical literature on this, it's often called linear. I mean, the people who work on this say they're doing linear algebra, because these are solution of linear equations. And there's actually, even yesterday, among these sophisticated people discussing the forefront of black holes and the latest computer science, there was an argument between those people who said we want to view this as a linear equation and those who said we want to view this not as a linear equation, namely as a matrix with right-hand sides and vectors, but rather we want to view it geometrically as a bunch of points on a grid. Typically, for this type of problem, it's best to view it geometrically, not as an equation. The introduction of the matrix is not useful, because the geometrical structure is what tells you how to solve these equations. Right. So, what we're exploring here is, although this will not be so easy to see. So here we're meant to have an example which is defined just so that I can draw it on one foil. So we have a simple case with a 5 by 6 grid and a 3 by 4 internal grid. So I've labeled the unknowns of psi. So the first unknown is of psi 1 for the 3, of psi 2, 3, of psi 3, 3, of psi 4, 3, and so on. These b's are the boundaries. So this says that we're trying to solve Laplace's equation with Neumann boundary conditions. Neumann boundary conditions says that we know the value of the function on the grid. So we've already done this problem in the homework. I gave you Laplace's equation, I think, with one on the, something very simple on the boundary. So that's Neumann boundary conditions. You know the solution at the edge. In order to make this well-defined, you must have the values of the edge. Otherwise, it's just ill-defined. Yes? I am sorry. Go through and do a global substitution of Neumann to Dirichlet. I should now say that, that to make this well-defined, we need to know either the value or its derivative. Its derivative would be the Neumann boundary conditions. Most examples that people do in textbooks are always done with the Dirichlet boundary conditions. So if you diligently take the equations that we had on the previous foil and write them out, so we have 12 equations for the 12 unknowns, you will find a nice equation here, a nice vector of 12 unknowns, and some sort of combination of boundary values, which is the right-hand side. Sometimes there are two boundary values because at a point like here in the corner, when I do the averaging of the neighbors, it has two boundary values as a neighbor. A point like this, I have one boundary value as a neighbor. So the equations have this structure you can hardly see. These are funny things here are zeros. You always have one along the diagonal. You have minus a quarters next to the diagonal, and then you have some zeros and another set of minus a quarters. So that's the classic structure of a Laplace equation or elliptic equation represented as a matrix. It's an extremely sparse matrix. It doesn't look terribly sparse in this example, because in general for this approximation, the matrix that which you're trying to solve has five non-zero values in each row and column. Because in each row and column, I have the central value and the four neighbors with a non-zero value. Everything else is zero. So you have five non-zero values. So if you only have a 12 by 12 matrix, 5 is a reasonably large number compared to 12. But if I had a 100 by 100 grid, it would still be 5. And 5 is not a very large number compared to 10,000. Notice the size of this matrix. This is something I always used to get confused about. Notice there are two things that are rectangular in this problem. There's the original problem, which is here. That's a rectangle. And there's a matrix, which is a square. But the size of this matrix is the product of the number of x values times the number of y values. So if this is nx by my internally, this is nx times my by nx times my. So this is a much bigger matrix than this geometrical system. This is the square of the size of that. And that either sounds trivial or confusing, depending on whether you think carefully. But that's why, if you like this. When written in matrix form, this is a huge matrix, most of which elements are zero. When thought about geometrically, there aren't any particular zeros, because zeros are implicit, because the zeros correspond to the fact that geometrically, the points only interact with their neighbors. Okay. This is a banded matrix, and it's got ones along the diagonal, minus a quarters on the two lines next to the diagonal, and then another minus a quarter further out. We'll look more generally at the structure later on. So that's shown here. So if you analyze this, where we happen to have multiplied the matrix by 4, just so I don't have to write minus a quarter on the foil too often. We have a matrix which is nx times ny is a number of rows and a number of columns. We have this constant diagonal, which for the particular scaling here is 4. We have a minus 1 next to the diagonal. And then if we have nx, grid points in the x direction internally to the domain, then we have a distance which is nx, then there are actually nx minus 2 zeros until you get to this non-zero value minus 1. And the reason this is, let me see. So the reason why it has that structure is the following. Here I have the original geometrical form. So if I take a point here, which interacts with these two points here, here's the one next to it in x, and here's the one next to it in y, then I need to form a vector. I'm solving for a vector which has got values defined at these grid points. So naturally this vector has two indices, I and j, or I sub x and I sub y. Then I need to, in order to write a matrix equation, I need to convert that two index formulation into a one index formulation. Because a vector, this is going to become, let's say, this is why it's a little confusing. This two-dimensional, this thing, which is the unknowns on these points, is naturally defined geometrically in two dimensions. When you write it as a matrix, it becomes a vector, because the size of the matrix is nx times ny. So I need to convert this thing with two indices into a vector, which I do by saying, this is the first element of the vector, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and so on. So I just enumerate the points. And I can do it in any way. I can go along the rows or along the columns, and I can do it like that, or I can do as I did, come back to the beginning. There are endless ways of converting, of converting something with two or more indices into something with one index. The simplest way gives you the zero structure we discussed, because when I go along these rows in the way I just illustrated, I start with this point. The next point I reach is the point which is 1 over an x, but that's linked to it in the differential operator, because that's the rightmost neighbor. So this corresponds, so this is the diagonal point in the differential operator. This then is the one that corresponds to the minus a quarter above the diagonal. Then we have 1, 2, 3, 4 zeros, because those points aren't involved. Then we pop down here to the one below it in y. That's related to it, so we get a non-zero value. Then the rest of the points are zero. So you can see that in general, you will always get a diagonal, a value next to it, with the two diagonals next to the main diagonal, will be non-zero. Then you will move over nx minus 2 or m minus y minus 2 if you choose to label it the other way for zeros. You'll get another non-zero value and then the rest is zero. So that follows that just follows from the fact that I converted something which was nearest neighbor in x and y, and I converted it into a one-dimensional formulation to be able to write it as a matrix. Now, there are some other ways of writing it. So you can write it in other which correspond to different ways of mapping these values defined on the grid into a vector. So there are so-called and it is not obvious that the way I described is the best. And so that if you read the work of say Sanjay Ranker's students, they used to work on, and they presumably still do, on space-filling curves, which are nifty ways. See, this is sort of crude to keep going along rows and just go along rows. Space-filling curves are ingenious curves which wander through space and preserve locality. But there is no good way of doing it. There is no curve that sort of wanders through space in such a way that it touches all the neighbors and keeps all neighbors next to all neighbors. There's some presumably neat piece of mathematics that shows that that's impossible. So you are unable to preserve locality. When you can go from two dimensions to one dimension, it is not possible to preserve that locality. If you could, it would make life enormously easier and make the solution of these equations much easier to do. So you can change the locality, but you can't make it local. You're always going to get this band which is far away, nx minus 1. When I do three dimensions, you can see I'm going to have two outlying bands, one corresponding to the neighbor. If I now go in three dimensions, I'm going to have some points up there. I'm not going to get to the point that differs by 1 and z until I've run through all the points in this plane. So in three dimensions, I'm going to have a band which is nx away, and then another band which is nx times my away. So three dimensions are even worse. They'll have a very far out band. But there is nothing one can do about that. So when you read the discussions of linear algebra, they will always talk about sparse matrices. And they will discuss them. In fact, they should discuss them with great vigor, because the most important matrices in the world are always sparse. And the reason they're always sparse is, well, all the matrices that come from differential equations, or these partial differential equations, are always sparse, because partial differential equations have these differential operators in them. The differential operators are local in x, y, and z. When you discretize those operators, convert them into a matrix equation, you're bound to get a sparse matrix. Now, there are various other, if you look at other types of problems, you will find other sparse matrices. And in general, the statement is, if you wish to be, do the most beautiful and solid work and the easiest, in some sense the easiest in terms of neat mathematics per unit time work, you'd like to have full matrices. These are matrices where everything is non-zero. The parallel algorithms and the numerical analysis for full matrices are much simpler than the parallel algorithms and numerical analysis for sparse matrices. But sparse matrices are by far the most important and dominate numerical methods. All right. Well, here's a bold statement that says we must use iterative methods. So we better, and there's some foils later on to justify that statement. So you could argue that my statement about sparse matrices being more important than full matrices, in some sense, is obviously ridiculous, because a sparse matrix is a special case of a full matrix. So if you have a nifty subroutine to solve full matrix problems, you have a nifty subroutine to solve sparse matrix problems, because you just define the matrix with all those zeros and you're fine. The reason why that doesn't work, of course, is that that's very inefficient, because your poor old computer will be spending all this time multiplying zeros into everything. And so we'll get the right answer, we'll get the right answer, but it will be computationally off by some huge factor. So except in very special cases, like in one dimension, you can use full matrix algorithms, okay. But apart from special cases, full matrix algorithms cannot be effectively used for serious partial differential equations, because they're too inefficient, and even if they weren't too inefficient, as we'll see, they take too much memory, because it takes too much memory to store this miserable matrix. So but the full matrix algorithms are the only direct deterministic ways of solving the equation. So if you go to a linear algebra course and they tell you how to solve matrices using Gaussian elimination or some other method for solving linear equations, that in some sense is the only way of solving linear equations. I mean, all the sophisticated ways are variants of that method, the first approximation. And so that's the only way that starts at the beginning, gets to an end, and the actions of the, what you do is totally deterministic. But I say those methods don't work. So the only way to solve elliptic equations in which are at all large, and this is the only way to solve them in three dimensions, is to use some iterative method or some ingenious method. It's not quite true you have to use iterative methods. You can use so-called spectral methods, which effectively correspond to expanding the function, the solution in a set of functions. But let's ignore spectral methods. If we ignore spectral methods, once we get to this, as long as we do discretization, the only way of solving them is by iterative methods, which means that we have an approximation to the solution, and given that approximation, we need to find an iteration that gives us another approximation, which approximation is hopefully nearer to the solution than what we started with. So that comes back to what we did with the Jacobi iteration. That was an iterative approach which solved Laplace's equation in that example in a square. So iterative methods actually have some relatively obvious physical or mathematical interpretation, because if you wish to solve for a particular elliptic equation, say del squared c equals naught, then one physical way of doing this is to start with any old distribution for I guess it's a psi, not phi, and then solve the diffusion equation, which has the psi dt equals some diffusion constant times this differential operator, because the nature of diffusion equations is that, if you have a source of heat and you go to time equals infinity, that heat's gone. It's diffused throughout whatever region it is, and it doesn't have waves. The heat doesn't come and go in some oscillatory fashion. It diffuses to some asymptotic form, which is the answer. So that says that the characteristic of a diffusive equation is that at infinite time, the psi dt is zero, namely we've stopped varying, and therefore it must be that what's on the right-hand side is also zero, which is del squared of psi. So the solution of any, if I form an artificial diffusion equation where we have a first-order differential of time on the left-hand side, the elliptic problem I want to solve on the right-hand side, we know the solution at infinite time of this diffusion equation is the solution of the elliptic equation. Now that's sort of interesting because the diffusion equation has a deterministic solution method. You start at time equals naught, you evolve to the next time step, and 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 it's completely deterministic. It's you step in time. There is no... that's what it is. So you can actually view any of these iterative methods, although this sometimes gets a little contrived, you can view an iterative method as equivalent to solving an artificial diffusion equation where when we iterate, we're just marching forward in this artificial time. And so there's a one-to-one mapping. So actually, if you look at the solution of Laplace's equation by iteration, that looks like exactly the same as solving the diffusion equation with Laplacian as the spatial operator, which is actually a common case. So there's a very strong numerical and physical analogies between iterative solutions to elliptic equations and time step solutions to parabolic equations. So what happens? So we actually look at this and sort of motivate class of solution methods. So supposing we take this diffusion equation and convert it in and do finite difference, then on the right-hand side we get the standard stuff. The average of the four neighbors minus the we just get the average because we just get this thing here should be psi. Yes. So this actually is a psi. So this should say the average of the four neighbors minus four times the middle value, and at the on the left-hand side, we get the value at tau plus delta tau, where tau is this diffusion time, minus the value at tau, and we haven't really done time marching problems, but when you it's sort of what we did for ordinary differential equations. When you have an ordinary differential equation, you're marching it in time. You can evaluate the spatial derivative. We're only discussing evaluated at where you started, and the best is in the middle, and we had these various ingenious ways of using the Runge cutter and things to be able to estimate, get a better approximate for the average derivative. So in principle, this tau in quotes should be the value in the middle, but actually this will converge, albeit more slowly, if it's the value at the beginning point tau. So So if we now label things, if we now say a psi at tau plus delta tau is just the psi labeled by n plus 1, a psi at tau is the psi labeled by n, we will find we had on this side something that was like a psi of tau plus delta tau minus a psi of tau. So that's going to be an psi of tau plus delta tau. On the right hand side we get our four things here, but we don't actually get minus the value at the center, because we get that there is a contribution which came from taking the one here and moving it over to this side. And so actually what you find is that you get a quarter of the neighbors and you get minus the central value, but it has an unknown coefficient C2, and then we have here multiplying the psi of n plus 1 a C1. And if you look at the value of C1 and C2, they add up to 1. The actual, for this particular artificial way of deriving it, the particular values of C1 and C2 depend on this artificial diffusion constant kappa, H, and delta tau. And so this method suggests, this way of looking at the iteration suggests that you introduce, that you do not necessarily fix that to be 1, which is what we did in Jacobi iteration. And in fact, in general, what you end up doing is, this is called the method of successive over-relaxation. You choose the value of C2 and then C1 as 1 minus C2 to maximize the convergence of the method. So we will actually go through three methods. There's the Jacobi method, which is actually what we've illustrated already. That corresponds to the choice C1 equals 1 and C2 equals 0. The Gauss-Seidel, which corresponds in a somewhat peculiar way to choosing that value of calculating the derivative of some combination of the beginning point and the end point in tau, and an over-relaxation which ingeniously chooses C2 to optimize convergence. So all the standard simple iterative methods correspond to different approximations in this diffusion problem. Alright. So so we'll now go through the so-called stationary methods. So these are called stationary methods because the iteration equation is the same iteration equation at each iteration, and you do not change the form of iteration. These are also the least satisfactory iteration methods, and the non-stationary iteration methods, of which the best known is the conjugate gradient, that has an iteration where the iteration changes its form at each step. All of these methods, all these iterative methods, are all characterized by having a natural geometrical formulation. And have the natural locality. And the Jacobi is the weakest method. Gauss-Seidel will turn out to be somewhat better than Jacobi. Successive over-relaxation is in principle better than Gauss-Seidel. I believe it is hard, it is now rarely used, because if Gauss-Seidel is not good enough, which is often the case, you would almost always do conjugate gradient. So I think the advantage of successive over-relaxation is it will turn out to be as easy to program as Jacobi. menu, so it's very easy. The disadvantage is that it's hard to tune and predict what to do. It is not as reliable as conjugate gradient, and you might, as people have written conjugate gradient, you might as well use conjugate gradient. So I think SOR is sort of a thing of the past. I'm not aware of I'll do this foil and stop. Alright. So what we've done up to now today is we've sort of introduced the general types of PDEs. We then showed how they become matrix equations. We noted that iterative equations were quite natural, methods were quite natural physically. Now we're becoming numerical analysts or linear algebraists or something, and we're formulating, we're now writing out mathematically the different methods just in terms of their matrix form. And so we're solving the equation AX equals B. A is the matrix, which remember is largely zero, meaning everything is zero. X is the solution vector, which is going to be, in our examples, the values of psi or the field at internal points. B is going to be, which is mathematically the right hand side, is in an example, it's essentially the boundary values. We're going to solve it iteratively with a label called K. In order to write out these various these various iteration methods, we want to write A as B minus L minus U, where D is the diagonal, so which is all ones or all fours, depending on how you write the Jacobi method. U and L minus U is minus the upper triangular matrix. Minus L is the lower triangular part. It's everything below the diagonal, excluding the diagonal. And then we get these very. So these iterative methods are characterized by, I believe, for most elliptic problems. Well. For all the simpler elliptic problems, they all converge. The rate of convergence is different, as we'll see for them, but they will all converge. For complicated elliptic problems, they're not guaranteed to converge. And the analog of these methods, which are used for hyperbolic equations, are probably guaranteed typically to diverge. So you can actually, you can make a few remarks. So I meant to make a remark about iteration, which is sort of saying that as a computer scientist, one is at a disadvantage because almost always the choice of iteration and the reason for the divergence is somehow connected with the science. And the only people who can solve the problem are the sort of computational scientists studying that problem, because usually it's connected with the physical system you're solving. Like in the case of numerical black holes, we have a divergence, which they're currently studying, which is connected with the so-called inner boundary, which is the boundary of the black hole. And so that inner boundary has a very important physical significance, that there's a physical principle that no information can come out of a black hole, because light rays are bent, and because of the strong gravitational attraction, no information can actually escape from a black hole. It starts out in the middle of a black hole, bends, and comes back in. So all information is trapped in a black hole. So that says the boundary of a black hole is a very important physical statement. And yet here you are, you gaily put down your grid points and they slap in the middle of a black hole where the equations are meaning, where it doesn't mean anything. And so in formulating the way you do this boundary, you have to understand deeply what happens physically at a black hole boundary. And and you will find the same is true in computational flow dynamics, where the boundaries are connected with so-called boundary layers, which are very closely connected with the physics of airflow and the viscosity, etc. So typically what computer scientists can do is they have to provide tools which scientists can then use in an artistic fashion to try to make their equations converge. Because there is no mathematics which will tell you whether or not these methods converge. If you are solving a Laplace's equation, you can do some mathematics to tell you whether or not it converges. If I give you a general, typically nonlinear physical problem, which in some limit reduces to the Laplace's equation, you can just smile and say, well, you know, there's some theorems that apply in special cases, but in the general case, all bets are off. So what you have to do is you give them intuition as to what might happen. So if you're a numerical analyst, you can give them some general theorems which never apply. As a computer scientist, you can give them some tools to do some experimentations. But the basic work is either the art or the science of the computationalist in those various areas, sitting there seeing that it converges or diverging, and saying, well, that convergence is due to try to understand it physically and extrapolate to different problems to see how to apply, which method to continue to apply. So, and as I mentioned, it can take many, many years to establish reliable convergent methods for a given problem. And so that's one of the reasons actually parallel computing has taken so long to catch on, because you can't hand somebody a parallel computer and say, oh, it's 100 times faster, why don't you go and find out what black holes do? Because when you go from the two-dimensional problems you did on your simple computer to the full three-dimensional case of a physical space-time, you're going to get to a whole new set of iterative methods, and you haven't the slightest idea offhand which ones will actually work, because there are endless different discretizations, there are endless different choices of coordinates and different formulations of the problem, and you need to, and it's now not at all obvious which ones are going to be the most successful. So it turns out that computation is not a deterministic science. It only becomes engineering once people have done the pioneering work, found out the tools that work, and then they can encapsulate that into a black box that tells you what happens when air goes over the wing of an aircraft with a certain degree of approximation. But even then, I mean, people do not have reliable codes that tell you what happens when air goes over an aircraft wing, except in approximations. There is no reliable method of solving the Navier-Stokes equations in general. So what we're going to therefore focus on next time is we'll go on and describe these tools, but we will never be able to tell you which tool works on a real problem. And that's life. That's why it's a science, you know, this is science and it requires research. But you do require to be the application scientist to do that. I believe very rarely is the solution found by, if you like, the computer scientist. It's almost always found by the person who understands the science. Okay, thank you. And I will put up a homework on the web, and the next meeting will be Thursday, not Tuesday. I'm away next Tuesday.